Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on this Wednesday, June 11th. 62 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City and 59 degrees in Heber City under some partly sunny skies. On the phone with us now from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good Wednesday morning, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Wednesday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at a mixture of sun and clouds as we go throughout the day here across the region. As temperatures start off on the mild note, we'll see highs climbing to around 90 degrees for the Heber Valley this afternoon, with high temperatures into the mid-80s across the Park City area. Now, as we go throughout the afternoon hours, we're going to be seeing a chance of an isolated shower or storm developing here, as we've got a weak disturbance that's going to be moving by well to our north, but it may graze extreme northern Utah, giving us that chance of a couple of isolated downpours, maybe some lightning, and also maybe a brief bout of some gusty winds. Should not be a major deal, but a chance of a few isolated storms nonetheless this afternoon. That chance will quickly fade as we go into this evening and tonight, as we drop down into the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. We'll drop down into the low 50s there in Park City, and then as we go throughout the day on your Thursday, get ready for more sunshine to return for us in both Park City and in the Heber Valley. We're looking at those high temperatures in Park City climbing back into the low 80s for highs, and we'll see those highs in the upper 80s to near 90 for the Heber Valley. As we move into your weekend, you expect more of the same. Lots of sunshine and warm conditions. Highs will climb into the mid-80s there for us in Park City, with high temperatures climbing into the low to mid-90s in the Heber Valley. It's going to be a hot one, so make sure you are staying hydrated. Don't forget that sunscreen, and also, of course, making sure that you're checking on the pets as you go throughout the weekend here. That trend will continue right on into our Sunday. Your Father's Day forecast is calling for temperatures to start off in the 40s and 50s. But guess what? We warm up into the upper 80s in Park City for highs on Sunday, with highs in the mid-90s for the Heber Valley. So a scorcher of a Father's Day. And then as we head into next week, we'll continue to stay with the warm temperatures, but we'll slowly begin to cool it down. Highs, it'll be only in the mid-80s in Park City for your Monday. We'll be looking at highs still in the low to mid-90s in the Heber Valley. But by the time we get towards Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll see those highs dropping closer to 80 in Park City, and highs closer to 90 or a little less in the Heber Valley. That's your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City resident Jen Drummond on a quest to summit all seven summits. That after already finishing all seven second summits. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias previews this week's City Council meeting, including the adoption of next year's fiscal year budget. And Heber Valley Chamber Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner with a rundown of some of the upcoming events happening in the Heber Valley. Well, Park City resident Jen Drummond is the first woman and only second person in the world to successfully summit the world's second tallest peaks on each continent. She's now working on summiting the tallest peaks on each continent. She recently returned from her attempt to summit Denali, the largest peak in North America, but bad weather shut the team down. Jen joins me now in the studio to tell us a little bit about the adventure and what's next. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good morning. Hi, everybody. So Denali was a bugger this year. I headed out with a team of two people, another person from Utah named Matt. And unfortunately, when we got to Camp 2, Matt got sick. So the Rangers gave us a tent to quarantine him, and we hoped over the next 24 hours he'd start feeling healthier, but he didn't. So he had to be helicoptered off, which left myself and another guide, and she was a junior guide and had not led an expedition before. So at that point, we decided, you know what, it's probably not the safest to go up this mountain without a third person. Weather didn't really give us the best option either. If we had great weather, we would have pushed it. But the weather was iffy, other things were iffy, and when things start not adding up and you want to come home with all your fingers and toes attached to your body, you make the safer decision to go down.
Yeah, so Matt, I mean, it was more than altitude sickness and then, huh?
We're not quite sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it presented as a stomach bug, but when he got down to sea level, he was feeling a lot better. So it could have been a combination of both. And that's the unique thing about altitude sickness. You can have success on the mountains every time you go, and then one time randomly get hit with it, and you just never know.
Well, let's just take a step back and start with a little bit of history about how this goal setting all came about.
Yes. So I was in a horrific car crash in 2018. Thankfully, it did not kill me, and it actually woke me up to living and realized we have this beautiful planet that should be explored. And I was going to climb a mountain for my 40th birthday. My son thought I should climb Everest instead of the mountain I was climbing. I hired a coach to help make that possible, and that coach upped this goal to set a world record. and show women globally that we can be moms and other things that bring us excitement and joy.
So you have completely, you have successfully completed all of the second seven summits, but we say seven summits and yet you, I think, climbed nine?
Yes.
So explain that.
Yeah. So there's seven continents, but I guess there's a dispute on what's a continent. So when it comes to climbing, they want you to cover every possible option. So in Indonesia, a lot of us think of Indonesia as part of Asia, but some people consider Indonesia as part of Australia and call it Oceania. So if Indonesia is a part of Australia, then the second highest point and highest point are in Indonesia, and Australia doesn't get to count. And then because of the political things going on with Russia, they wanted me to climb mountains in Europe if we excluded Russia from Europe. So I climbed Mount Rosa in May of 2024. And then I climbed the highest peak and the second highest peak in Indonesia in October of 2024. And so when I filed with Guinness, which will actually be in the Guinness World Record book in September, so yay, full circle moment, I realized I only had three mountains left to climb all the highest peaks. And one of them was Denali. And Denali's our home-based mountain, so I really wanted to do that. I have one in Russia still named Elbrus and the Mount Blanc. And I'm actually going to sign up to do Mont Blanc in April of 2026. You can climb it during the summer, but it drops a lot of rocks, so it can be kind of dangerous. In April, you get to ski it. And so you can ski up 7,000 feet from a hut to get to the top, and then your ski down is about 12,000 vertical feet, which sounds like a dream for any of us that are skiers, so I'm here for it.
All right. So you've got three left to make the seven tallest summits?
Yes, well, nine, right? I'll cover nine of the seven tallest.
Nine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll have one Elbrus in Russia. Mm-hmm. I'll have to go back to do Denali at some point. Denali's a May-June climb. And then Mount Blanc, depending if you want to hike it or ski it, you can do it at different times of the year.
Okay. So will you have time to go back and do Denali this summer?
I'm not going to do it this summer. My oldest graduated from high school, and all of us parents out there know that we try to squeeze all these moments in with them as much as possible. So I'm actually taking the kids to head to Peru, and we're going to climb Machu Picchu. Because that's a family-friendly adventure. Denali is not.
Okay. So, again, talk a little bit about that. Because being up on, and you're calling it Denali. I mean, it's
McKinley.
McKinley Mount. Denali is the Alaska name for it. Yeah. Tell us that you were on the mountain for 11 days before the decision to turn back. And as you mentioned, you have a high school graduate.
Yes.
So there was some kind of deadline also kind of pushing you there, too.
Yeah, so one thing I did learn about Denali is that you really should give yourself as much time as possible, because weather storms come in and they can come in for a few weeks, and then that will destroy your expedition. But for me, like, my true summit was coming home and being here for graduation. And so when that started to flirt with the deadline of me needing to be back in time for that, I was like, hey, there's other summits on this mountain. And so when I started to turn around, I'm like, what is my new win? Where can I show up and just be like, hey, this was a little summit, that was a little summit. And so on my way down the mountain, you know, I ran into a person that had an injured foot. I had a million blister packs now because I don't need them anymore. So I gave them all my blister packs. I gave all my snacks to other people that were gonna try to wait out the storm. There was some other women that were trying to set records as the fastest known time to climb Denali. And so how can I support her and what does she need? And you get to still be a part of other people's journeys just because yours didn't end the way you hoped.
Yeah. It hasn't happened too often, but you have had to back off.
I have. So K2 took two tries, and then Mount Logan, which is the second highest point in North America, located in Canada, took two tries. So I guess that's just following suit for this continent. Weather is such a factor. We're 100 miles from the Arctic Circle. And so the barometric pressure plays a bigger role in these mountains, even more so than Mount Everest. So Denali's weather was the harshest weather I've been in. And I've been to the top of Mount Everest. I've been to Antarctica. I've been everywhere. But you just have the moisture in the air. And then that just makes everything that much harder. I was sleeping with a hot water bottle. Like, we'll melt water, we'll heat it up, and then we'll put it into our sleeping bag. I was in a negative 40 degree bag in a tent with another person, which helps keep the body heat in. And when I woke up in the morning, there was ice in that water bottle.
Oh.
Yeah, no fun.
No, that's cold. Did you, what do you do? I mean, when you get the weather and the weather doesn't go away, I mean, how do you spend 16 hours of being awake doing nothing?
Yeah, no, we do things. You get really creative. It's kind of funny because you can tell when everything's going well on the mountain because all the little camps are like bare minimum. And then when things are not going well in the mountain, then people start cutting out ice bricks and they'll start making walls to protect the tent from the wind, or they'll get bored and they'll make snowmen. And like everything just becomes like a more mature neighborhood with everybody up there. And you start to, we have some of the tents that are not for sleeping, they're for socializing. So people will get together and they'll tell stories, they'll play card games. You do anything you can to pass the time.
Yeah. And then as you start to make that decision about, it's not going to happen, to talk just a little bit about the feelings that kind of go through that and the emotions.
Oh, yeah. No, they leak out your eyes. Like, even though you know it's the right decision, it's still all the things you put into it just coming ahead of, like, this isn't going to happen this time. And the day that we went down, a couple other teams went down, but three teams tried to Hail Mary pass and go up. And so when they're going up and we're going down, you're like, am I making the wrong decision? Like, really? And we had to start going down at 5 p.m. at night because even at this time of year, the sun starts shining 15 more minutes every single day in Denali. And so it starts to break and get crevasses. So it's safer to travel at night to go down the mountain. So like the whole day you're sitting with your decision. Did I make it right? Did I make it right? We got back down to base camp around 2 a.m. set up a tent, and then the next day actually got good enough weather to fly off the mountain, and everybody who went up had to come back down, which is a little validating on what you picked, even though you want them to have success because they put the effort out there, but it also just reconfirms that you made the right decision.
And I was going to ask you that. I mean, why not wait until, you know, the end of June when you've got so much daylight, especially that far north? It becomes more dangerous, you're telling me.
Right, yeah. So you have to play this balancing act, right? So in May, if you go climb Denali, it's going to be colder, but the ground's safer, and you're like, I can dress for cold weather. My thought was in June, if there starts to be crevasses, like that's a little more dangerous game to play, so I didn't want to do that. If I was to do it again, I might split the difference and go a little bit later in May. That gets me into more of June and just travel in the evening.
Okay, so the next climb, you're still kind of working out details then?
We're working out details. It's not the best time to go to Russia right now, so I'm not going to go over there and flirt with anything and cause drama. Mount Blanc, I do kind of want to do the ski thing, and the best time to do that is in April, and it also gives me a long time to train, and actually one of my sons thinks he's going to train with me to go do it with me. So I'm really excited about that, and that gives us all winter to work together on that project.
All right. People can follow along. You've got a website, blog,
yes,
podcast.
Yes, all of it. So I have a podcast named Seek Your Summit. Website is jendrummond.com, and on Instagram it's at the Jen Drummond.
Okay. And then why does it take so long? I mean, you finished the second tallest summits a while ago. Why does it take so long to get into the Guinness Book?
I don't know, to be honest with you. And they told me that I'm in the book and still haven't sent the certificate. I'm like, okay, well, can I have that too, please?
Yeah. Did they go back and have, I mean, what do you have to provide to them to prove?
Yes. So to be able to get a Guinness World Record, you have to have photos, and the photos will kind of give, and then you have to have GPS files that show where you were, and you have to have two people that can verify that you were there and they were there with you. And so every mountain, we kept all of that information and kept it in a file and then turned it in.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, have a great time with your kids. And anything else you want to tell us?
No, thank you, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Jen. Jen Drummond again, Park City resident, the first woman, only the second person in the world to successfully summit the world's second tallest peaks, and on her way to attempt all of the tallest peaks again next year. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. A gas leak evacuated Park City's Main Street for hours yesterday afternoon. Park City officials said a private contractor, the Toro Blanco Group, hit a natural gas line while installing wireless infrastructure on Main at 4th Street about noon. Park City Police and Park City Fire District officials evacuated businesses, residents, and tourists from Main Street, Sweet Alley, and Park Avenue, south of Heber Avenue. Old Town businesses resumed operations about 5 p.m. when pedestrians were allowed back on Main Street. However, it remained closed to cars between Sweet Alley and Heber Avenue last night. The city said it had no involvement in the construction project and Enbridge Gas would lead the repair efforts. A spokesperson for the Toro Blanco Group couldn't be reached for comment yesterday. No injuries were reported. Well, as we just reported, a gas leak evacuated Park City's Main Street for hours yesterday. In the studio to tell us a little bit more about that, as well as a preview of this week's City Council meeting, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. So the evacuation yesterday, I guess that was kind of good training, if nothing else, for the team?
Yeah, I think. Thank you for the positive outlook on that. Obviously, numerous different types of first responders to that incident. It was one of the main lines for gas on Main Street, so it's obviously a very dangerous event, potentially. I also feel bad for our public utilities team. We've done a tremendous amount of work over the last 2 years with the Main Street business merchants. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I think the first inclination was, you know, sort of, shucks, what did the city do here? We're working on its water project. And so it wasn't us. We had no trenching in the street that day. It was a private contractor that's installing 5G technology and fiber throughout the street. And obviously, we have a rigorous permitting system, you know, blue stake requirements, this, that, and the other. But unfortunately, it just sounds like a mistake was made in the field. So, you know, obviously we have a stop work order with that contractor at the moment, and we're going to have some discussions about how to protect the street in two ways. I mean, protecting the life safety element of doing something potentially that dangerous, and then also the impact on our small businesses to shut down the street for the employees, for the guests, for the visitors. It was quite an event.
Yeah. So when people evacuated, where did they all go?
Well, a lot of people just sort of went to depot locations, the police department, the fire district, and even the gas company and our emergency services team. We're partitioning portions of the street and using setback tape, so having people stay sort of out of what would conventionally be known as a blast area or a potential blast zone. And I think it went fairly well. So one of the staging areas was here in Bob Wells Plaza. There was some tape here at the end of the street. There was also another staging area at the top of the street. Tried not to impact the areas that were outside of that zone, sort of lower Main Street. But I think our emergency services team sort of came in, did the necessary means and measures, rolled out the tape, and then partitioned people where they need to go. We did have some people that didn't want to leave their facilities. That's a natural thing that happens in an emergency, where people say, I'm staying here. I'm staying with my equipment. I'm staying with my animals, with my people, with my property. We understand that. So actually the chief of police was going door to door and just talking people through, you know, the potential danger and the situation and giving facts as they may. People have some discretion in that. You know, people can say, hey, live free or die. I'm going to stay where I am. But people were overwhelmingly compliant, and the chief said, you know, the few people that really felt like they needed to stay behind, once he had a conversation too, they were very willing to move on.
Yeah, it just seemed to me to be safer inside than outside. So why do you move people outside?
Well, we're trying to get them out of the zone. So it actually doesn't really matter inside or outside of the building. The idea is to get outside of sort of the radius of the zone. And when you hit a main line, working with the gas company, they quickly worked with our emergency responders and said, you know, I don't know the exact square footage, but said, hey, can you get people outside this buffer zone?
Yeah, and I know that people who had vehicles on Main Street couldn't get those until much later in the day. The concern was just an ignition switch could blow?
Yeah, a spark, an ignition switch. It is uncommon to hit a high-pressure line of that magnitude. You've been living here long enough. You've seen the construction. I was working from home last week. Two doors down, a landscaper hit a fiber line. It knocked out my Wi-Fi. I had to go to the library to work for the rest of the day. And, you know, these things happen, but a high-pressure line like that in a commercial environment that is so heavily permitted and regulated. We go to great lengths to try to make sure that doesn't happen, particularly in an area like the historic district with all of the businesses, all of the employees here, to prevent something like that happening. It's different sort of it's in a rural area and not that impactful, but you know, it was a scary event, and fortunately we turned out, and there were some inconveniences, and we're sorry for that.
Yeah, I do just want to note and kind of pat ourselves on the back here, because it was so weird, because I was still here. I mean, I'd gone out, and then it's like, no, I need to get stuff, and I need to do a few things before I leave, but I kind of walked into the on-air studio here, listening to the radio, and nobody's sitting here in the DJ seat, so that was all done remotely, and so I again, some of the emergency broadcasts, things that we've got in place here at the station, where it was cool to see them like come to fruition.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm aware we worked with KPCW and the two other local media outlets in town, as well as our emergency texting system to reach as many users as possible.
Okay, taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow, fiscal year 2026 budget set for approval. Anything you want people to know? We've been discussing it for months now.
Yeah, I just think, by and large, a very modest budget increase, probably the most modest in about a decade. We really tried to look within this year and try to find efficiencies and savings wherever possible. But there are some really positive improvements moving forward on the community center building and City Park, which is conventionally known as our summer camp building. We provided additional resources to make sure we can complete the pools and the aquatic center at the Mark, continuing to invest in our neighborhoods and quality of life and mitigation measures. So a balanced budget, no property tax increase, but by and large, probably the most modest budget in about a decade.
Also on the agenda, a discussion on the Recreate Transit Study Report. This is just the first step to meet all federal funding requirements. Hands down, the bus rapid transit system looks like the best option in terms of moving people from outside the area along 248 into town. It's cheapest and it keeps vehicles and onto 248 where they belong and kind of preserving the rail trail for pedestrians and cyclists. So what's next with this process?
Well, we probably need some more direction, policy direction from the mayor and council about sort of which of the alternatives that we've been screening that they prefer, and when I mean which of the alternatives, plural, doesn't necessarily have to be one. You know, we can still keep some things in the bucket. And then probably a discussion about the phasing. I think there's probably a phasing element in terms of which alternative you're seeking to implement in the next, let's say 5 to 7 years, and then, maybe what happens on, the year 10 to 15. I think there's another element of that. And then there's probably some additional public outreach, I think. One of the alternatives contemplates something like using the rail trail, and I think that would need a significant amount more of public outreach and engagement. But we are, stuck in this conundrum of people wanting a tremendous amount of public input and engagement in our planning processes, but yet every time we sort of add an element of planning and community engagement, people will often, or other people often, sort of gripe about the time that it takes. And so here we are running through an alternatives analysis process probably 12 months faster than what is normally scheduled. We picked up information from the previous studies done on 248, and we sort of escalated that process and accelerated that process to get there faster.
So when does the public have a chance to provide input on the options?
Well, in the staff report, it actually alludes to the fact that they've had several opportunities already, most recently at the Community Projects Open House that we conducted at the library, where I think, don't quote me here, I want to say 50 to 75, I can't remember the number, that actually visited this particular booth and participated in some surveying elements. We've had an online survey element. And then herein lies another opportunity. We're publicly sharing this information. People can come provide public input. It's another opportunity.
And then at about 4:10, a bus rapid transit update for SR 224. There was no staff report when I looked at it. So what options is the council considering here?
So it's sort of the two additional elements from the previous week that we didn't get to. And the first is the layout of where the bus rapid transit will approach what we're calling, I guess, sort of the Box of Rocks intersection, which is Jans and Coles conventionally in the community. And it's an incredibly important intersection in town. It experiences, at times, high levels of congestion during peak periods, and there's a tremendous amount of turning movements at any given time. And they often conflict because we have, buses, emergency vehicles, residents, or just sort of local residents, and obviously high volumes of skier traffic and tourism and those trying to get to Main Street. And so it's hard to sort of satisfy all of those needs and then buttress that with transit priority only lanes. And I think the question for council is balancing sort of the day-to-day use, utilization, look and feel of that intersection to ensure its compatibility with our community values, and buttressing it with an elevated level of transit and BRT service, at least at this phase, which would go all the way to the Old Town Transit Center. I think if we are to provide just a transit-only lane, it probably includes some widening or a taking potentially of a current traffic lane or a turning lane, which at times could make the congestion worse for cars, but better for buses. And herein lies the conundrum. There are things that we can do to improve the transit experience, but it is often at the expense of the passenger experience in an automobile.
Yeah. So when we talk about going to the Old Town Transit Center, are we talking about via Park Avenue or Deer Valley Drive?
Deer Valley Drive. But, you know, like I said, you have multiple sort of demand-based trips in that intersection, residents, resorts, Main Street, on and on we go.
Okay, so that was one option. What was the other? You had mentioned there were a couple?
Oh, I'm sorry. And the other one is, you know, we have several BRT stations as you approach the city, sort of from the White Barn inbound, or actually outbound, and sort of trying to make sure that those are the appropriate size and scope. And one of them is sort of the Thanes location out by the White Barn, making sure that that location is, again, aligned with our community values, but can accommodate the BRT system. And I think the initial scope had been a pretty large station, and we were having some conversations about, you know, what's the utilization there? How many people are taking trips there, and is it right-sized? And then looking at the additional locations on the way into town.
With High Valley Transit saying that staging work could begin as soon as August, it sounds like the council needs to figure this out sooner than later.
Yeah, and I had someone the other day sort of poke me on this, you know, say, why are you toiling about this meeting after meeting after meeting? And I, you know, quite frankly, just said some maximum level of transparency. Like, these decisions are being made in a public meeting out in the open with UDOT, High Valley Transit, Summit County, and Park City at the table. There's probably no better demonstration of us working together. Kind of, this is the meat and potatoes of what we're doing, making these decisions in a public meeting. It's not always pretty, and it can sometimes be laborious. And I think that's where we are right now, as we're coming down towards the end of project design, making these final decisions, but doing them in an inclusive way where the community has a tremendous amount of oversight.
Then at 4:40, a discussion on waste diversion. This follows the Summit County Council's discussion happening today. So will the council be meeting with all of the parties like the Summit County Council is, so that everybody feels like they're on the same page here?
Yes and no. I think it's all of the above. But, you know, obviously trying to just ride on the coattails. You've asked me several times, you know, why is this taking so long? Can we accelerate this? Can we move faster? We've been working on this for years. And so I think you can see both the Summit County Council and the Park City Council pushing this into the public realm, having back-to-back meetings in a short time period, having Recycle Utah in the room, and knowing that, I'll call it, the Summit County or the Wasatch back of the basin needs some sort of comprehensive solutions or satellite solutions, and both of us sort of using these public meetings to push towards solutions.
Well, and unlike what you just told me, that we're like getting out 12 months quicker on 248, it just seems like we have known for years, again, last 5 years, that Recycle Utah it's got to move. And I guess I'm surprised that everyone knew this was going to happen and yet no plan is in place. So, I mean, where did we drop the ball here?
I don't know if we necessarily dropped the ball. I don't know if that's the case. I think, you know, the municipality for almost 30 years has provided Recycle Utah with land for free and provided almost $100,000 of operating funds for them to operate a facility within our municipality. Waste services and recycling are typically a county responsibility in the state of Utah, where counties provide the services and run the landfills, and we've worked with a nonprofit to elevate the level of service in our municipality. We've had development plans for a long time in the Bonanza area that have had sort of starts and stops, and as we are narrowing our approach and trying to underground power lines, this has obviously become more time sensitive. However, several months ago, the county and the city got together and offered some land potentially to the nonprofit that they wanted to continue to operate. And I think that's where the discussion lies today. I think the municipality and the county are likely inclined to step in and provide some type of regional facility, unless there's some type of a partnership that we could continue with the nonprofit Recycle Utah, much like we have partnerships with other nonprofits throughout our community. I think of the Christian Center, who runs a food pantry and other types of services, where there's sometimes a local provider that has expertise or experience or labor that the municipality or the county doesn't have. We rely on those services and we contract for them.
The staff report says that Summit County and Park City offered the 4-acre parcel within that Gilmore subdivision. I thought the city had transferred all of its holdings to the county.
No, that's not the case. The city still has, for layman's terms, an outstanding land obligation. And the county and the city got together and said, hey, it's a creative way to satisfy that obligation working with a third party. Now, I don't want to overstate, you know, that's also a lot to ask for a nonprofit. So you can say, okay, here's some free land, but now you've got to go raise money for a multi-million dollar facility and operate on a long-term lease. So, you know, I'm not throwing shade here at Recycle Utah about what they're being asked to do. It's a considerable undertaking for any nonprofit. It's also a wonderful opportunity. I don't know if it will work out, and I think if it doesn't, you're likely to see the city and the county step in and provide something.
All right. During the regular meeting, the council will get an update on House Bill 356. From whom?
I believe Melina Stevens has been sort of appointed the chair of the, I don't want to call it a redistricting, I'll call it a districting committee. And so we're going to have just an update from Melina Stevens, a former elected official who's been appointed to chair this committee, and provide sort of an overview of what's occurred and what the plan is moving forward. Obviously, Park City has a stake in this in terms of if county members, county councilors are going to be cut up into districts, you know, where those district boundaries are drawn. And so this is our sort of first 411 from the individual appointed to run the committee.
Yeah, I mean, is it the city's position that, the city needs to remain intact instead of kind of being split up amongst the county?
I think that's a policy decision that our elected officials will get to make or lobby for or ask, and I think that's what they'll probably contemplate and consider after they receive the briefing.
Okay. The council will also decide tomorrow whether to buy two vans to facilitate the transit to trail service this summer. I'm talking about $230,000. So we're going to have a total of five vans to make this happen? Is that...
Yeah, it's a little confusing. We had two pieces of equipment that we were going to sunset because of their lifespan. And there are regulations with when that happens, and Park City tends to be sort of very proactive with that regard in terms of wanting a quality fleet. Other jurisdictions run them much longer than we do and will run equipment until they're very, very tired. So for us to extend two pieces of equipment before we sunset another 6 months, we can onboard two new pieces of equipment that were formerly used in our paratransit services, and we can combine those to provide this level of service. Make a long story short, we had a contract with another vendor that didn't work out, and so we're sort of coming in here to cure this at the last minute.
Okay, so it sounds like there'll be four vans, and as a result, frequency will be increased to 20 minutes instead of every 15 minutes because you don't have enough vehicles, is that why?
That's correct.
Okay, so is there a plan to bring on more vehicles eventually? You're just going to kind of do a pilot project and see how it goes?
Yeah, I think we're going to run it this summer. It's obviously an elevated level of service for the purple route and see how it goes. I mean, 15 minutes was very aggressive. That's an extremely high level of service. We think 20 should be satisfactory, but who knows? I could be back in here 6 months from now saying, wow, the utilization was out of this world, and our transit professionals are recommending that we enhance the level of service. So we shall see.
All right. And also, you're looking to federal money for transit. Are those federal dollars as plentiful for transit vehicles as they have been in the past?
Not sure what the outlook is on that. We are obviously watching that closely, and we work really closely with the team in Washington, D.C., both our federal delegation and our lobbyist that represents us. You know, transit money and transportation grants and services at the federal level is one of the things that has continued to flow. And in terms of flow, I'm talking about the application processes and criteria. I know there's been no major disruption in that area yet, and we have our fingers and toes crossed. As you know, about 80 cents of every dollar we spend on capital equipment here for buses and electric charges is subsidized by the federal government. So it's an incredible return that our community, our guests, and our residents receive, that almost 80 cents of every dollar on capital equipment is funded by the federal government.
The council will consider a resolution on its affordable housing guidelines that will basically repeal and then replace the existing guidelines. Biggest change sounds like we're going to change income targeting from area median income to workforce wage, hoping to what, that we're actually closer to what most people are earning as opposed to that kind of this artificial AMI?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case. Over time, I think the AMI has just sort of gotten away from us due to some of the income disparity in our community. And we think that a workforce wage is a better metric. Now, there's a way of overlaying the workforce wage in Park City with what that results in AMI. And so instead of being, let's say, an 80% AMI, it's more like 50% AMI, which is a lower level, a lower threshold. So we'll be targeting lower thresholds and sort of the lower rung for community housing. And it's a pretty aggressive move by the mayor and council. It's really putting their money where their mouth is and trying to target some of those on our front lines and lower incomes and making sure that they qualify for our housing, but then can afford some of our subsidized housing. It's one thing to receive some subsidized subsidized housing that you can't afford, and it stretches you too thin. We were trying to hit a better sweet spot here.
The resolution also says dwelling units that are deed restricted to the housing size and type for individuals meeting occupancy guidelines approved by the council. So under this resolution, can one person live in a city-owned deed-restricted three-bedroom unit alone, or what does the city's occupancy guidelines require?
No, I don't believe so. I think the point you're trying to make, and I'll just say it differently, is trying to right-size occupancy with the type, size, and location of the unit. We have studios, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom, and so obviously, a three-bedroom, you're looking for multiple members of a household, studio, probably no more than two, and this is in an effort to maximize the resources. If the public is subsidizing housing, you want those housing units maximized for their use, so you don't want a single individual in a three-bedroom. Conversely, you don't want five individuals in a studio, and so this will right-size some of that for us.
Okay, so will that change then? Because we do have somebody living in a three-bedroom city-owned property.
I guess it depends on the property and the deed restrictions. So we've had different types of properties built over, I don't know, the last 40 years here in Park City. And so I think it depends. It depends on when someone enters that unit. It depends on the deed restrictions for that unit and how it was built and under what purpose. But I think as new units come on board, we're constantly refining our rules and regulations and trying to right-size those.
All right. The council tomorrow will also consider the contract with White Pine Touring to lease the Golf Pro Shop for its winter operations. This would be for a five-year extension on top of the five-year contract that already expired. So are there any options to extend after that, or do we just move into this five-year extension? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I think it's the option to renew for 5 years. We've already had 5 years behind us. So in totality, it's sort of 10 years of certainty with this one milestone in the middle at the five-year mark. And we've updated some of the terms and conditions, like more inflationary measures, covering some of the municipality's costs. And then we've had a bunch of additional operational controls, like reducing the amount of special events, better parking management. But if council approves this, that would provide with certainty another 5 years for White Pine to provide the concession to the community to operate Nordic on our golf course.
Yeah, that new contract shows a huge rent increase, about $2,000 a month. So why so much all at once?
Well, I think it's just a reflection of the time. It's been 5 years since that was increased. So you can imagine, what we pay in gas or for salt or sand or equipment or trucks in a five-year span. And so we ran, I believe, the Western CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and just tried to value the price increase.
Okay, because I thought the contract allows for annual inflation adjustment. So those weren't...
It will going forward. That's part of the amended terms and conditions.
Okay, so that didn't happen, and that's why we've got now this huge...
Yeah, and I think historically we hadn't had these huge sort of real estate property value rushes, and we had an incredible one coming out of post-COVID, and so now we've just built these into many of our leases across the board. You know, we have concessions at the library and other areas, and so we're building in these CPI components.
And that's exactly what I was going to kind of ask, because we do have other city concessionaires, Park City Film, Lucky Ones, PC Tots. I mean, do they see rent increases like this?
So it depends. It depends on when those leases were initiated. I think going forward, though, again, given this sort of meteoric rise in property values and rent values and lease values in our community, I believe this is going to be a new standard. Now, I say it depends because it can depend on the facility and the types of services that are provided and to whom. We may have a concessionaire that's largely providing services to locals, and we may seek to subsidize that in a way. We may have a concessionaire that's primarily focused on, let's say, tourism and visitors and guests, and we may seek to lower our subsidy for that. So I guess it depends on the facility and the service being offered, but this is becoming more of the standard, trying to include an inflationary increase each year. I think to your point, perhaps that makes it easier on the vendor. It's not these 5 or 10 year milestones where it feels like a large amount. It's more incremental and keeps up with their ability to raise prices over time.
So under the proposed contract, it says that White Pine must also offer reduced rate season passes throughout the season for Park City residents and individuals owning a business within the 84060 zip code. So do we require that of other entities? I mean, I don't get local discounts at Park City Film or Lucky Ones.
I think you may in the future. So when these leases come up, it creates this new opportunity to have these conversations. We've been in here multiple times talking about the mayor and council trying to continue to provide affordable access to its services and facilities and things that are happening in our facilities, create an opportunity for that. We have all sorts of things in our recreational programming that provide subsidized access for local residents, and I think this is just but an extension of that. So when these other leases come up, we're going to have to cross those thresholds and have those discussions.
Okay. Matt, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. On the phone now with an update from the Heber Valley, Public Relations Manager for the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce, Jessica Turner. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Lots of events to get through, but it's hard to believe that we are talking December already, but here we are with tickets on sale for the North Pole Express.
Very true. And it's important to let people know when these tickets go on sale, because all of the trains will sell out. So they started the sale on Monday, June 9th. So all of the tickets for the train are now available for purchase.
Okay. Also, we've got the demo derby and rodeo tickets on sale. And this is interesting because people had to go in person. Do you think this has helped?
You know, I do. We've had some issues, or the county, I should say, Parks and Rec has had some issues with scammers in the past, as well as equity, among residents and those interested in attending these events. They do early ticket sales for some of the county employees as a perk for being a county staff member. But for the general public, they've had a hard time allowing access for everyone to get tickets for the event dates. They sell out so quickly, and then it's really hard to get seats together if you're going as a large group or as a large family. So this in-person event this year was the first time they've done this, and I think it was very successful. I would anticipate this is something that they will continue to do at future events for the rodeo and the derby.
Okay. And it's a season of live music. Where do people find out who's playing where?
Yeah, certainly. We try to capture all of these events on our website at GoHeberValley.com on our events calendar page. It's a community events calendar. There is live music happening every single day of the week. There's a couple of new series happening at the Heber City Park in conjunction with the upcoming ribbon cutting of the new stage, the main stage at the Heber City Park. Sundays and Monday nights, they'll be offering that complimentary music for the community, in addition to the Heber Market on Main happening on Thursdays, which has live music component to it as well. Midway Town has brought back their live music series happening Wednesdays. Cafe Galleria is doing live music Friday, Saturday, Sunday. In addition, they've got a few other weekdays that they're doing some live music out on their patio. So there is just opportunities everywhere to see live music, most of it free. And again, all of that being listed on our website.
All right. Did we get the bandstand open at Heber City Park for the market?
Oh, it's so close. It is so close. I think, you know, as any big construction project goes, there are a lot of unknowns, particularly when you start digging underground and looking at the infrastructure and the utilities, the historic, in some cases, utilities and infrastructure that needs to be torn out or redone. I think that's caused some delays, as well as scope creep for the budget of the project. They keep putting out dates and times as to when they're going to be complete. But at this point, they have solidified that they will be doing a ribbon cutting on June 19th. So I think they're holding themselves to that date at this point.
Okay. And again, that happens throughout the summer, the Heber Market 5 to 9 at Heber City Park. You also have an ice cream social coming up.
Yes, we are sponsoring the night of June 26th for that Heber Market at Heber City Main Street Park. We will be offering free Rooney's Ice Cream Cups, which is a local ice cream manufacturer here in the Heber Valley. In addition, we have 20 or so of our chamber members that are going to be offering different toppings. So it's free for all. Come anytime from 5 to 9. The earlier, the better. We tend to run out. We typically do 1,000 cups of ice cream that night, and it's adults, kids, anyone and everyone is welcome.
Okay. What else you got going on?
Yeah, I can rattle through some of these. So, everyone loves some good free yoga and farmers market combo. That has returned for the summer. That'll be every Saturday, June through October at Midway Town Square. Yoga starts at 9 a.m. and then the farmers market kicks off from about 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Again, encouraged to arrive early if you have a preference on the vegetables, fruits, or flowers that you're looking to purchase, as they tend to run out toward the latter part of the day. In addition, July 5th, coming up at Midway Town Hall, June 21st through July 5th, it all culminates on July 5th, will be the return of the Wasatch Plain Air Festival. Now, this is a watercolor and painting artist event. People come from all over the country to participate in this. It is instructor-led and guided for the artists, but general visitors or community members can stop by, see the artists painting, kind of like the animals out in the wild, see the artists out there. In different viewpoints across Heber Valley, gathering inspiration from the landscapes and the historic buildings and homes. And then it all culminates with a festival where they can sell their pieces.
Okay, what else?
Let's see, we've got kids trains coming up June 27th at the railroad. You know, the railroad honestly has an entire summer of themes, trains, and different events and free live concerts all happening at the depot. So all that's available on their website. We try to put as much of that on our website event calendar as well. Heber Valley Artisan Cheese does their cheese making classes for burrata and mozzarella every month, as well as cheese tastings once a month. Those are really fun and low cost to enter into those. By big demand, the Back to the 50s car show is returning. It'll be here at the end of the month, June 28th at Heber City Park. Then we've also got an art festival. In addition to the plein air, there's another art festival coming called the Wasatch Back Art Festival. It's July 3rd through 5th at Midway Town Hall. So both of those events will be happening in the same location over those same dates. You can see a lot of local art and art being done from artists that are coming in all over the country. The biggie for our office and for our valley is, of course, July 4th. I know Park City also has a big July 4th parade and celebration. For those that are looking to get a race in the morning at 7 a.m., we're kicking off with a 10K and 5K, as well as a family fun walk. We've got a Joe Nichols concert that night. So the race is a paid event. The Joe Nichols concert is a ticketed event. Most of the other festivities will be happening, including the parade, the games, the market at Heber City Main Street Park. And most of that's complimentary throughout the day. So it's an entire day from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. and it concludes with fireworks that night. So yeah. Full fourth.
Where does the parade happen?
Parade's going to happen just to the west of Heber City Main Street Park. So we're actually going to have that parade route go on the same path as the 5K, 10K route in the hopes that people will arrive early to get their spot for the parade and then thus cheer on the runners as they're completing those races.
Okay. Wanted just to mention, we've got some news happening with UDOT and the Heber Valley mm-hmm. bypass. I think that's happening today, the discussion, yeah?
I believe so, yes. We're trying to stay updated on that. Of course, UDOT working with the county and city officials and the council members to keep them abreast of what the decision-making, where that's headed. We're down to two final options from UDOT. Both of them have a very similar entry point over on 189, but they've got a couple of different access points off the north end of 40 on the north end of Heber City. So we'll see where that ends up landing. They have committed to having a final decision and route discussed and disclosed by spring of 2026. So a little under a year away from now. I'm hoping they can fast track some of that and maybe move that timeline up a little bit, but not wanting to rush the process either, because we understand, you know, with green space and with some of the beauty of the valley, we want to protect as much of that as we can as well. It's a delicate balance.
Yeah. And we also still have the sewer and water line repairs happening in Heber and Midway, huh?
Yes. A lot of our town right now is under construction. You know, as Park City is also well aware, with the winter season being what it is, they try to do as much as they can from that spring thaw till fall. So spring to fall. And they are hard at work. We're really grateful for our public works departments across the valley, county and cities. They work really diligently and work really hard to try and mitigate as much as they can of road closures and having heavy equipment out on streets, because summer is a very busy season for us. But that being said, you know, slow down, pay attention, try to be respectful and appreciate the hard work they're doing, because it's happening all over the valley this summer.
Yeah. And Grace Dorfler reported on the new historic walking tour. Sounds like a fun thing to do.
Yes, yeah, I think so. We're going to be getting that added to our website within the week so that there will be a digital landing footprint for that as well. But we do have the walking maps and all the information in our office at the Visitor Center on the north end of Heber City Town. I think Midway has done a really nice job of preserving a lot of its history, and it's had a walking tour for some time, for a number of years now. This is an opportunity for Heber to also embrace, Heber City, that is, to also embrace the historic homes and buildings in the area. We get a lot of visitors that come in and ask specifically about the history of the area, and they want to know about Fort Heber, which was one of the original founding settlements of the valley over here in Wasatch County. We finally have an easy-to-understand, self-guided walking tour that we can now provide for those individuals that are looking to understand the history of the area.
Okay. I leave it at that. Jessica, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Jessica Turner is Public Relations Manager with the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce. You're listening to KPCW Park City.